I want to introduce Dr. Jay Olshansky, a professor of epidemiology and biostatistics from the University of Illinois in Chicago. I appreciate you joining us today.
Sure. Happy to be here.
Just a quick introduction, if you don't mind. Can you share a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in human aging, or as I ask a lot of persons, how perhaps human aging found you?
Yeah, it's actually an interesting story. I was a graduate student at the University of Chicago in the PhD program in sociology with an interest in adolescent fertility. And my advisor suggested I take a course from a famous scientist by the name of Bernice Newgarden in human development. And she knew of my interest in demography. She had just completed a book that was funded by the National Academy of Sciences on whether or not the US government should be funding research designed to slow biological aging in people. And she said, I want to know what you think. You know, what happens if we succeed? And so I, you know, picked up the book. I started reading it. I couldn't stop reading it. And I then went to the library. She asked me if I would write a paper on the topic, and I said, sure. She said this would be the main paper for my for the course. And, you know, I wrote a paper that was like an inch thick. I swear I didn't come out of the library for months. I became absolutely enthralled with it. I was consuming every article I could find, every book I could find on the question of how long humans can live. And when I handed this to her, she took one look at it, read it, and she said, if you'd like, you could turn this into your master's thesis, because this is about as thorough a treatment of the field of aging and longevity as she had ever seen. And I said, sure. And from that point on, this was 1979, I was hooked on aging and longevity. And I, ever since then, have been consuming every single thing I could find on the topic and the issue of how long humans can live. And of course, now I've written extensively on the topic myself.
Yeah. That question, how long can humans live? That was a question I was going to ask you, because you study this quite a bit. You've written extensively. What is, you know, how long can a human being live? We see a lot of experts out there, and we read a lot of their works that suggest that, hey, there's persons out there that can live well to 150 or 500, or maybe those that have a history of living to their families to 70 or 80, we can extend that 20 or 30 years. But what's the reality?
Yes, I'm glad you asked the question that way. So, you know, there's a lot of hype in our field of aging about how long people can live. And let's just deal with the facts for the moment. The fact is that no human has ever lived longer than 122 and a half. Mm-hmm. One woman by the name of Jeanne Calmon. She died in 1997. She lived in southern France. No one has come close to 122 since then. In fact, very few people have made it past 115 since then. So when some of my colleagues ask the question, what's the maximum humans can live? Yeah, it seems pretty obvious. It's somewhere between 115 and 122. And it's just not really possible for humans to live much beyond that. Now, in terms of averages, life expectancy in 1900 was about 50. Today, it's about 80 in most developed countries, maybe a little bit higher. That's an average, or, you know, a rough average. It's a life table estimate of how long people born today can live. And so, you know, the question that one might ask is, how much higher can life expectancy go? How much higher can the average go? Because I don't think the maximum can really go much higher. And even if it did, it, you know, it's one person that's making it that far. It doesn't have much meaning to the rest of us. And I said in an article, I published an article back in 1990, so this was 32 years ago, that the upper limit to human life expectancy was about 85, about 88 for women, about 82 for men, maybe a little bit higher. You know, but we can't really push it much higher than that. In order to get up to 85, by the way, you have to have a lot of people survive past 100, which is happening. So the answer is, for a population, about 85 to 88 somewhere. For individuals, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if somebody broke Jean Calment's record of 122, you know, maybe 125, maybe 130 under extreme circumstances. But the human body wasn't designed for long-term use. And so pushing out these bodies that far just doesn't work. You get a failure of the neurons in the brain. The components of the body fail, the heart muscle, the cardiovascular system, loss of muscle mass, loss of bone density. These bodies just weren't designed for long-term use. It's, you know, when somebody asks me this question, I usually sort of turn it around and say, well, you know, how fast do you think we can run? What's the fastest we can run? A mile, just by way of illustration. So the current world record is 3 minutes, 43 seconds. And I will ask anyone who's you know, wants to learn about this issue of upper limits to human longevity, how much faster do you think we can run? You know, can we run a mile in 1 minute instead of 3 minutes, 43 seconds? And everyone says, oh, of course not. And I say, well, why not? Well, what's stopping us? And the answer that is most often given is the human body can't is incapable of moving that fast, no matter how hard we try. You could tell your legs to move faster, but it doesn't work. And it's the same thing with human longevity. We could talk all we want about living to 150 or 200 or 250 or 500 or 1,000, but the human body wasn't designed to last that long, and it's not going to. So yes, there is an upper limit to human longevity. And interestingly enough, this question of whether or not there's an upper limit came up during testimony that I gave a week and a half ago in the US Congress on human longevity and aging and whether or not we're going to have an aging intervention. And they were asking this, it's an important question, because if there is no upper limit, then in theory, we could just keep pushing out the envelope of survival. If there is an upper limit and we're approaching it, that means that the focus should not be on living longer anymore. It should be on living healthier longer. And that was the overall message that I was trying to get across.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, you think about the forces that are out there today. CDC came out recently, the post-COVID kind of numbers, or during COVID, life expectancy has gone significantly down for those birth cohorts that are coming today. How does that factor into the equation? You know, if you could make a prediction, what's going to happen? You know, we've got a lot of these social ails going on, crime and addictions, and then at the same time, you have these kind of new diseases or viruses popping up.
Well, so I published a couple of articles on this topic. In 2005, my colleagues and I published an article in the New England Journal of Medicine predicting that life expectancy in the United States would drop due to obesity, diabetes, and a whole suite of related conditions. That's exactly what happened, by the way. Even though a lot of people didn't like the fact that we had made that prediction, that's exactly what happened. We said this would be the first generation of children to live a shorter lifespan than their parents. And it looks as though that may actually come true, unfortunately. We've got a lot of major risk factors that exist in developed countries, including diabetes and obesity, that are going in the wrong direction. You know, when COVID hit, it was not unexpected. Look, we've had three infectious disease pandemics that occur just about every century. So it was only a matter of time before we were going to have another one, and it wasn't exactly unpredicted. We actually wrote a paper on this that we published in 1997, suggesting that, you know, we better get ready. Something like this is coming. Now, when it happens, of course, nobody really knows what's going to, you know, how it's going to play out. COVID-19 hit, and there were lots of unusual elements to it. I actually am reluctant to make predictions. I started to make predictions at the beginning of COVID-19 and realized that almost every prediction I would think of making was wrong. And the fact is that we actually don't really know what the severity or prevalence of COVID is. I don't trust the data from the CDC at the moment that's coming out. The part of the problem is that we don't actually know how many people have had COVID. We don't know how many people have actually died from COVID. We don't know how many people are going to die from COVID, and we don't know what new variants are going to come along and influence survival and mortality in the future. What I can tell you is in the 1918 influenza pandemic, the H5N1 that hit, we had a pretty dramatic drop in life expectancy over a short time period, just like with COVID. And then there was a rebound that occurred a couple of years later. So the question is, are we going to get a rebound now in the next year or so? And I would say it's possible that this could happen, that we could get a lot, a natural immunity that eventually occurs. We might be seeing that now with the death rate going down pretty dramatically. The COVID death rate is now close to or lower than influenza. Just so you know, it's about 30,000 to 70,000 deaths per year in the United States alone. We seem to be comfortable living with that every year. So now, that's one of the reasons why the claim that the pandemic is over has been made. It's because COVID has become our, modern equivalent of influenza. Of course, if you add it to influenza, then you get 60 to 140,000 deaths instead of 30 to 70 occurring in a year. But I can't, I don't know. We actually don't know what the long-term consequences of COVID are going to be. I got COVID myself in April of this year for the first time. Had a couple of some rough days. But I've had the flu before, and I've had a couple of rough days with that. What we don't know is whether or not COVID is going to have a long-term impact on those of us that have been exposed. Is it possible that 10 years from now I'll get lung cancer as a result? We don't know. So the answer is, I don't know, and I don't feel comfortable projecting what the impact is going to be overall. But what I will say is that it's probably not going to have that much of an impact overall on life expectancy. Some have argued, by the way, that COVID culls the weaker members of the population who have multiple risk factors, multiple conditions in their bodies all at once. It removes them from the population, leaving behind a more robust subgroup. It's natural selection in action. But whether or not that plays out, I don't know. I don't know if that's actually going to happen. So the answer is, the three words that I teach my students to use all the time when questions like this come up: I don't know.
That's a good answer. you talk about, I heard a very, well, going back, I heard a very interesting interview on the radio the other morning, local station out of Oklahoma City. One of the physicians out of OU Health Sciences Center was talking about, these risk factors and COVID, but he said a more interesting group are the ones, or the persons and humans in the population that have not had COVID whatsoever. Are those the ones you're talking about that come out of the pandemic or of the state like this that are stronger? Do their genes pass on now? And are we gonna, is that a
No, not it's not really an issue. Think of it this way: the people that aren't that are dying from it, for the most part, are older. They've already passed their genes on to the next generation, so it's too late. Natural selection is not operating through COVID. So no, it's that's not going to happen. But you're right, there are subgroups of the population that appear to be either unaffected by COVID, or they're not getting it for reasons that we don't know, although I'm skeptical of that. It's entirely possible, perhaps likely, that a lot of people that thought they didn't get it actually did get it and had no symptoms. Now, that in and of itself is interesting. Why is it that some people can be exposed to COVID and have no symptoms at all? They're asymptomatic. That was one of the usual unusual elements of COVID to begin with, was the asymptomatic element to it. Almost no one that gets flu is asymptomatic. That when you have the flu, you know it. So COVID is a different animal, and why some people are not influenced by it is of great interest. And we'll eventually discover what it is among subgroups of the population, but I don't think that that's that subgroup is necessarily healthier They may be less susceptible to COVID and more susceptible to something else. It's just something unique about them. Why is it that some people have long-term health effects associated with COVID and others have no long-term health effects associated with COVID? Why do some people get brain fog and others do not? So these all represent subtle differences among subgroups of the population that are playing itself out in real time for us. But I don't think that this is evolution in action influencing gene frequencies. Remember that if you look at the death rate for COVID, it parallels the death rate for total mortality almost identically. In humans, almost all deaths occur between the ages of 65 and 95. Mm-hmm. And everyone who's 65 to 95, almost everyone, has already passed their genes on to the next generation. It is not natural selection in action.
Okay. Yeah, this is good to clarify. A lot of times students get confused by it and kind of misled by some of the things that they see and read. And you talked about in your work a term called longevity dividend. Can you explain this concept a little bit and share a little bit about what it means and what really are the dividends or benefits of living a long life? Or trying to get there.
Well, so think of it this way. If, in fact, there is an upper limit to human longevity and we've approached it or reached it, then why are we trying to make ourselves live longer? What we are doing to ourselves by, attacking one disease at a time, which I refer to, by the way, as a game of whack-a-mole. Well, once you get people that live out to very old ages, you get all these diseases that accumulate in older bodies. And you reduce one through medical technology or surgery or prevention or whatever. And, two or three crop up right afterwards. So it's a big game of whack-a-mole that we've created in public health. And so if indeed there's an upper limit, and we're approaching it, then the focus of modern medicine and public health shouldn't be on trying to push the limits out further. It should be on trying to compress the frailty and disability that occurs later in life into a shorter duration of time near the end. And that's what the longevity dividend is all about. It's basically suggesting stop trying to make us live longer and start trying to make us live healthier. For a longer time period. And that's where the benefit comes in. What the dividend is. The dividend is an extension of the period of healthy life. Will we live longer as a result of interventions that eventually yield an extension of health span? Yeah, probably. I don't know by how much. No one really knows, in spite of the fact that some of my colleagues like to claim that we're going to live to 150 or 200. They're all made up numbers. I'm not a big fan of making up numbers in the world of science, but unfortunately in the field of aging, it's a pretty common event. So the longevity dividend is nothing more than an argument that instead of attacking one disease at a time as it arises, which is it's called competing risks or the game of whack-a-mole, but in epidemiology, it's competing risks. One disease replacing another, we should really be focusing in on trying to address the underlying risk factor for almost everything that goes wrong with us as we get older, which is the biological process of aging itself, and not necessarily specific risk factors for diseases one at a time. And so the longevity dividend is an effort to slow aging, which is the primary risk factor for things that go wrong. And the result, we think, will be a compression of morbidity and disability and an extension of the period of healthy life. Now, the other part of your question is, what's the benefit of growing old? Now, this is a wonderful question to ask young students. And I have actually asked this of my young students, all of whom are in their early 20s. They're all graduate students. Some are in their mid-20s, maybe late 20s. And I will ask them, is there anything good that happens when you get older? I get such a kick out of their answers because almost universally they say, no, it's all bad. Everything that happens when you get older is bad. They see it in their parents, their grandparents, they start to complain about their aches and pains and, they get these diseases and they can't run as fast and they can't think as fast. And At least according to these younger folks, that's what they think is actually happening. And they don't realize that there's a whole suite of benefits that are associated with growing older, especially growing older healthy, with mind and body intact. And I've had this discussion with them. I said, is there anything good that happens when you get older? And they go, yeah, no, nothing. I'm going, well, yeah, I mean, don't you think it's possible that as people get older, they maybe they grow wiser, maybe they grow smarter, maybe they acquire knowledge and experience? Oh, yeah, I guess that does happen. You know, do they acquire more wealth? Are they more comfortable in their own skin? Are they psychologically more stable? Yeah, I guess. You know, you go through one after another and suddenly they realize, yeah, I guess all of those things that we want, we don't get until we get older. Right? Right. So, you know, they want that emotional stability. They want, you know, they want to be better off financially. They want to be smarter. They want to be wiser. Yeah. Well, guess what? You got to wait to live life to get up there to experience the benefits of old age. So as long as older age is accompanied by health, then it's a wonderful benefit. And my friend and colleague, Linda Fried from Columbia University, refers to healthy older individuals as the most, as the last rising natural resource that exists on the planet. And so we need to take advantage of this natural resource and help older individuals continue to contribute to society in important and meaningful ways, because healthy older people are you know, extraordinarily valuable in our world, and we need to nurture them as much as possible. And keep in mind, these younger people that you're asking the question of eventually are going to make it out to these older ages. So the benefits that we're pursuing now are eventually going to benefit them.
Invest now and the dividends come later. The benefits come later, yep. Especially in terms of one's health. Well, another question for you involves kind of thinking about your career and your research. Is there one discovery or one finding that you made in your work that was just, you didn't expect it? It just kind of, you know, may have been something serendipitous. It may have been something that you just weren't expected. And as you continue to investigate it, it just kind of came all together. Is there something in your career, when you think about the totality of your career, that one discovery, one thing that's really kind of shifted your thinking, or maybe even moved the field in new directions?
Yeah. So this is a really interesting question. I would have to say that the most important event that happened was a meeting that I attended way back in 1988, that was run by George Martin from the University of Washington on aging. And at the time we were talking about how long humans can live. And the question that kept coming up was this one: how long can we live? And at the meeting, it occurred to me that we were asking this question the wrong way. And instead of asking how long can we live, I would reverse engineer this question and say, well, how much would death rates have to decline in order to achieve these higher numbers that we were talking about, which no one had really bothered to look at? And so I went home and did the calculations, and I couldn't believe what I saw, which was the numbers were huge. The percentage declines in the death rates required to get life expectancy up higher were much greater than I thought. And so I went to a friend of mine, Bruce Carnes, who was also at Argonne National Laboratory, where I worked at the time, and I showed it to him. He did similar work, but with animals on survival. And I said, is this right? And he goes, yeah, sure looks right to me. The calculation was not complicated. So we did it over and over and over and over again, and eventually came to the conclusion that this is right. So we eventually published this as a lead article in Science, the title of which was In Search of Methuselah, Estimating the Upper Limits to Human Longevity, where we came to the conclusion that life expectancy could rise to about 85 to 88. And then after that, can't really rise much further, not because we can't reduce death rates, we can, but because the metric of life expectancy is an insensitive one. And that article really, it was completely unexpected. And interestingly enough, that was a purely mathematical demographic argument about upper limits to human longevity. But I quickly realized that that there was another related question, and that is, why is there a limit like that? Why can't we live to 120, 150 and higher? And that led me to the field of evolutionary biology. And my friend was a biologist, Bruce Carnes, and he started introducing me to the world of evolution biology. And I, came across articles that were written by famous evolutionary biologists in the middle part of the 20th century. I had already been familiar with the actuarial work that was done by Benjamin Gompertz in 1825, predicting mortality rates for humans. And as it turned out, the work that was done by the evolutionary biologists in the middle part of the 20th century provided an explanation for why Gompertz observed what he observed in 1825. And that combination of evolutionary biology and demography and the actuarial sciences led my friend and I, Bruce Carnes, to develop the modern concept of biodemography. That's where the modern concept of biodemography came from. It came from Bruce and I in an article that we published in the early 1990s with funding from the Social Security Administration. And as it turns out, the field of biodemography has taken off as a discipline ever since then. Interestingly enough, there have been some people that have claimed that they were the creators of the field of biodemography. And my friend Bruce and I laugh at that, because the interesting thing was, I first presented the concept at a meeting run by the Social Security Administration in 1992. And the one person who claimed he discovered it was at that meeting. His name was Jim Vaupell, by the way, who died recently, interestingly enough. And he said at the meeting, "Oh yeah, nothing will ever come of biodemography." And a couple of years later, he claimed that he was the father of the field. So, my friend Bruce and I were laughing at this. We're going, seriously, how can somebody actually get away with that? So the biodemography was an outgrowth of the combination of evolutionary biology and genetics and demographic actuarial sciences, and then ultimately this led to my favorite article that I've ever published, which combined all of this stuff together into one place. And it was an article that we published in Scientific American entitled "If Humans Were Built to Last," where we basically, Bruce Carnes and I and Bob Butler, the founding director of the National Institute on Aging, wrote this paper. And we basically said, yeah, this human body wasn't really intended for long-term use, and there's lots of things that go wrong with it. But if we could engineer it, if we could re-engineer, if we were the engineers and we could engineer this body to last longer, what might it look like? And that was the byproduct, that was the product of that particular article. It's my favorite article I've ever published, that where we that we basically explain what goes wrong, why there's limits, and we have to live with the body design that we have, which limits how long humans are capable of living. That's a long-winded answer, but it's a really important question, I think, and I was happy to answer it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Kind of, what would be your ultimate dream car if you could build it?
Yeah, I mean, some people were born with a Yugo body, and some people were born with a Mercedes body, and we know what that mortality distribution looks like. The ones with the Mercedes bodies inherited FOXO3 genes, which are associated with exceptional longevity. They got the right genetic polymorphism for ApoE. We know what the components are that contribute to exceptional longevity. We're beginning to learn what those elements are, and that's what's fascinating about the field of aging, and figuring out what in us contributes to longer life in some and shorter life for others.
Well, a final question for you is, this course that I'm teaching is really, the focus is on, we call it successful aging, for the lack of a better term, but just to kind of get the students to understand, the biopsychosocial type of components that go into living well, living long, whatever it may be. Rohan Kahn kind of coined this term successful aging, but I'm asking everyone to kind of give their take on that. How do you define successful aging?
It's an interesting dilemma because there's such genetic diversity in a population, it's inevitable that some people are going to die early. And for those folks that are going to die early, the goal is to live as healthy for as long as possible. That applies whether you can live to 30 or 50 or 70 or 100. So to me, the concept of healthy aging, or successful aging is unique to you as an individual. I don't define it as the observed health and longevity of one person, Jean Calment, who made it to 122, because we can't all live to 122, just like we can't all run a 4-minute mile. So the question is, for your body, for your body design, for what you inherited, what's the maximum healthy lifespan you can achieve? And that's going to be heavily influenced by how you live your life. Just think of it as how hard you press the accelerator on your car, how you drive that car. Well, how we drive these bodies influences how healthy they are along the way. And when we exercise and eat right, that's like an oil lube and a filter for your car. It's an oil lube and a filter for your body. It makes the body operate more efficiently for a longer time period. You don't have to do it. It works. And so the concept of successful aging to me varies from one person to another. I don't use a single individual or a single group of individuals as the basis for determining what success is. It should be unique to you, but it's basically maximizing your health span regardless of how long you live or how long you're capable of living. And that's my takeaway. That's my concept of successful aging. It varies from one person to another. Just because somebody else died at 50 doesn't mean they haven't successfully aged. They might have successfully aged up to their biological maximum. When if somebody lives to 100, but they spend the last 30 years, frail and disabled and not living well, one can determine or conclude that maybe that wasn't the case of successful aging. Now, let me step back on that question for a second, because some of my colleagues, I think appropriately so, have said, look, Jay, just because somebody is frail and somebody is disabled doesn't mean that they haven't successfully aged. And they may very well be happy, perfectly happy with their lives, even though they are experiencing some level of frailty and disability. So be careful how you define success. And I actually agree with that view. So, while I would like to see successful, I would like to see as many people survive out as healthy as possible for as long as possible. It's not necessary to achieve successful aging. There are people that can make it out, and live 10 years frail and disabled and be perfectly happy with their lives. And, maybe the concept of successful aging needs to be defined more by happiness than by health. And I'm inclined to buy into that argument.
Well, I appreciate your time today, taking time to answer a few questions, and I appreciate your contributions.
Yeah, my pleasure.